You're listening to a debate that took place on April 9, 2008, in Leavenworth, Kansas. The title of the debate, Does God Exist? Between Dr. Lee Basham and myself, Pastor Gene Cook, Jr. Be sure and check out The Narrow Mind at UnchainedRadio.com.
Okay, we're going to get started. And
I need to have to put my hat on.
My name is Pastor Damien Efta. I get the privilege of welcoming you all here. And I want to start by welcoming Dr. Basham to being with us. And Pastor Cook, we appreciate both of these men coming. But we primarily want to welcome you all because we're putting this on for the benefit of you and not necessarily for the benefit of a conversation between these two men. I pastor the Church of the Open Door in Leavenworth. We've been in the Leavenworth area for almost 100 years now. And we are a Bible church that believes that the Bible has all the answers to the important questions of life, both here in this world and the next. And so we want to find any way and any means we can to get that discussion of the Scriptures out in the public forum. And that's why we've decided to host this tonight. And so we're really excited about what is going to take place. We're looking forward to it. I've had an opportunity to have lunch with both of these men, and I have enjoyed my time with them. I'm sure you'll enjoy your time tonight. With that, I'm going to turn it over to Pastor Jay Lickey. He's the associate out there at the Open Door. He kind of put this whole thing together. He was the brains, the brawn, and everything else behind it all. So, Jay.
Thank you. Well, good evening. My name is Jay Lickey, an associate pastor at Church of the Open Door. And definitely excited about tonight. Been thinking about this and working on this and looking forward to it for a long time. So it's neat to finally see it all coming together here. I basically wanted to start out explaining a little bit about what a formal debate is. A formal debate is a debate that has procedures and expectations for both the speakers and for the audience. For the speakers, they are going to have certain rules that they need to abide by and time allotments for each section, and that will be explained a little bit later on. However, for the audience, what we're asking you to do is to hold all applause and any type of outbursts or anything like that. Please hold that because being a formal debate, we don't want to eat up time with any of that. We will have a time later on when you can show your appreciation for these two gentlemen and what they've done this evening. Where laughter is appropriate, that's fine, but please hold any type of applause or the outburst as we mentioned. We are going to have, if you notice on your kind of your little bulletin that you should have been handed when you came in, if you didn't get one, you can go to the back and pick one up. One of the things on that is that we are later on going to have a question time. We're going to allow some questions. And how this is going to work is, as you're sitting there thinking, you're like, boy, I've got a question, and it's burning, and I really want to ask this. What you want to do is write it down on the place where you'll see where you can write a question, who you want to direct it to, kind of fold it over, bend it over, and tear that off, because we're going to have a short intermission in the middle, and we'll pass some baskets around, pick those questions up, and then we will choose some questions out of that. I've got some gentlemen from the Free Thought Society or club in Kansas City. They'll pick out some questions for Pastor Cook. I'll pick out some questions for Dr. Basham, and then we'll ask some questions from you guys to these gentlemen. Couple other things to remember is to put your cell phones on silent mode, and I will lead by example right now. So make sure to do that. Okay. And I just turned it on video mode. How did I do that? Okay. Also, bathroom. If you need to use the bathroom, it's going to be back here to my right. Go down the stairs. You'll see the bathroom doors. You can make a note of that. With that, I wanted to introduce our speakers with a very brief introduction because you've got a little bio in your sheet there. Dr. Lee Basham comes from South Texas. He's a college professor of philosophy at South Texas College there. He is somewhat familiar with East Texas. I believe he spent some time at KU Is that right?
East Kansas.
East Kansas. I've been visiting some family up here. It's been great to have him around. He's already spent some time a little bit around here. And when we put this invitation out far and wide, he was the one that graciously accepted our invitation. So we're excited to have him here. Pastor Gene Cook comes from Southern California, and he is a pastor out there of a church in Temecula, which is, I believe, just north of San Diego. He hosts the Narrow Mind radio show in addition to pastoring, and something you can access on the Internet. I've got the website there. He did mention if you'd like to sign up for some updates and postings that of different events and things going on with the Narrow Mind broadcast, that we've got a little sign up in the table back there that you can put your name and email on, and you can get some stuff from him. Our moderator tonight is Mr. Ken Church, right here. When I first started putting this out, I was asking teachers, debate and speech teachers in the area, if they'd be able to do it. Many of them couldn't for one reason or another, so they couldn't, but they said definitely contact Ken Church. He is the man for the job, and he definitely is. He has around 35 years of experience in forensics and debate, and so he knows what's going on here. He's a native here, lives in Leavenworth, taught at Lansing in the speech and debate area, and still coaches forensics, and in fact was even doing that last night, I believe. So we're excited that he is here to do that for us. With that, I'm going to turn it over to him. He's going to explain a little bit about what he's going to do, and then we're going to get started. So thank you once again.
Thank you very much. I'm pleased to be here tonight and pleased to see so many people here tonight. My job tonight is really that of a kind of a referee if we need one, but mainly just to keep track of time and keep us on track to where we're going tonight. As Jay said, there will be really two central parts of this debate tonight. The first half will be opening statements by both of these gentlemen, 15 minutes apiece. Following that will be a four-minute cross-examination of each of one another. And then there will be a five-minute rebuttal for each of the debaters tonight. Then we'll have the intermission. It's going to be very short, so don't plan to go too far. And following that, we will have a cross-examination time a little bit. Again, a cross-examination, 4 minutes for each of our gentlemen tonight, and then another five-minute rebuttal for each, followed by the questions from the audience. And those questions are very important. They will each get three questions. Now, the general rules for the debaters tonight are that they stay on topic, that they do not go over their time allotments, and the cross-examination, those are questions, not speeches. They're not times to filibuster or just to kind of drone on and on. It's a time to ask a question and allow the other person to answer the question. When they are satisfied that they have received the answer, that you know that enough answer that they want, since it's their time to ask questions, they may stop the person who's being questioned by saying, "I am satisfied with the answer, therefore you can go on with another question." There should be no more questions after the four-minute limit, and you may finish, though, your responses. Even if that time has gone up, you may finish your sentences and go on. So, with no further ado, I would like to have our first presenter begin the debate tonight, Dr. Basham, with an opening statement of 15 minutes. Dr. Basham, welcome to Leavenworth.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Do you want this with or without the hat? Because I brought the hat. Bienvenidos, mis amigos. Okay, there's our hat for you. A couple of things I want to clarify. First thing, I'm used to teaching. Standing here trapped in front of this thing or behind it is kind of a problem for me, but I'm going to try to hang on to it, not wander away over there or that way. My task tonight is to represent a position. This is where I'm coming from. I'm thinking about telling you some things about what atheists say and how they think. And so when you're listening to me, you're not listening to anything I am or am not committed to. You're listening to me report to you something from the front. Okay? So it's important to keep personalities out of this. In other words, don't shoot me in the parking lot. Okay? Okay. It's all, we're good. Okay, we're good. All right, then. Now, There's so much to cover here. It's going to be very difficult, but let me begin as best I can. Probably what stymies a mind that has not been indoctrinated from youth in belief in God is the very notion of God. And by that I mean God's possibility. If someone came to you and said, there's a thing you can't see that made everything you can see, it has all power and all knowledge, and by the way, it's morally perfect, all appearances in this world aside, and you had never heard that, and you were an adult, you might question the very possibility of that being. And it's extremely important that we face this up front until we have some sort of showing that this being is possible, then all bets are off for anything else we might say. If we don't know that God is possible, then we don't have any way of evaluating any arguments for God. Because if we haven't already established the very possibility of the thing you're trying to show exists, then anything you say on the assumption of that possibility is moot. This has to be established from the get-go. And recognize what a strange thing that is being offered you. When you're children, it's very, very easy to accept virtually anything as possible, but not as you get older. And I think there's a lesson in that. There's a wisdom in that. You develop a certain credulity, and the incredible becomes more and more apparent. Now, why would we worry, just beyond the mere fact that we've never, at least I've never, and most people I know have never encountered such a being, why would we worry that it was possible on other grounds? And I think probably the most pressing ground, and this is increasingly pressing as our cognitive science and our abilities in psychology increase, especially in neuropsychology and artificial intelligence, it becomes increasingly pressing to explain how God could have a mind. Now, if you want to offer me an entity that does not have a mind and call it God, if you want to say God is love, that's fine. But that's not the God we're talking about tonight. The God we're talking about is a chooser, a judger, a decider, an intentional actor that, among other things, intentionally chose and enacted the world. What is this God made of that it could be and do those things? Well, most of you, if you're Christians, are probably Trinitarian Christians. I know Gene is, and I know our pastor is, too. This God is made of something they call ousia, which just means substance. But the substance isn't the substance of our flesh or bodies. We're not Mormons here. Any of you are Mormons, right on. Here's the thought. This immaterial substance, we know nothing about it. We've never observed it. We know none of its properties or capabilities. But to build a mind, what we know nowadays is it takes a lot of complexity, a lot of diverse parts, related in exquisite ways. But we have no idea if this substance even exists, if this substance is even possible. We have no idea if it could support the architecture required for a mind. This is a problem. If you want to say there's another kind of mind, a mind we've never fathomed, then you're right back. A partless mind, a mind without pieces or relationships. You're right back to the possibility. Problem, is that possible? So I want you to chew on that a bit. Atheists, especially people who grew up without religion and then are approached by religionists, I've often heard them say things that seem to revolve around that worry. Now, the other thing that I think has bothered people who are skeptical of God for a long, long time, and what first was really made clear during the 18th century by a group called the French Freethinkers, is what's the source of the idea of God? And I think it's very plain. The idea of God is absolutely, entirely borrowed capital from the natural world and its ideas and its relationships. This God appears to be a really big guy. He's everywhere. He knows everything. He can do anything, and he never gets it wrong. And you look at the process of human conception. We're learning more. We're gaining power. And fail though we usually do, we're trying to be better people. You take that idea, then you invert it. And the thing that we're working towards, this better place where we have greater powers, better wisdom, and more decency, you put that at the beginning of the story. And you say, it was all there in the beginning. Everything that humankind has been struggling towards was there in the beginning. This is obvious borrowing. And the view that Gene is going to ably defend tonight, Mr. Cook, Pastor Cook, is largely derived from a gentleman by the name of Van Til. And I think we can see probably where Van Til got his idea from. Because what Van Til is going to offer, and Gene's going to offer too, is that all of these basic concepts, truth, justice, these concepts that seem plainly natural, and certainly were familiar with natural people long, long ago, they're actually Christian concepts. They actually started with the Christian God. And they're all borrowed by anyone who's not Christian. But that's exactly the opposite of the answer the French free thinkers gave. So sometimes I wonder if what Van Til did was take this very well-known group of philosophers and turn them on their heads. Consider that. When I talk to physicists and I talk to scientists, and I have some background in science, my original studies were in biology, I discover a great deal of skepticism about the usefulness or even the existence of the God hypothesis. Now, an astrophysicist is someone who's thinking big. They want to explain the universe, the entire universe. And that includes space, time, galaxies, solar systems, planets. And then once we get on the planet, then we turn it over to the geologists, and we turn it over to the biologists. But when you ask an astrophysicist, what do you think about God? Their answer is what I like to call the National Geographic view of the world. And the National Geographic teaches us that there was this thing called the Big Bang, right? Now, it's important to know that's not an explosion. It's an expanding envelope of space-time. But the deal is we have almost to a level that is shockingly exquisite been able to predict from certain basic physical first principles almost everything we see in the sky today. Not just in the solar system, not just on the face of the moon, but across spans that separate millions of galaxies. They can tell you a very elaborate and almost fully complete story about how what we've got up there happens. It's a wholly natural story. It's a wholly physical story. Now, why should we accept the story? The standard method in science, when you're trying to derive a theory, is you want explanatory power, you want predictive ability, and you want simplicity. So then the question becomes, can the God hypothesis compare in terms of explanatory power, explanatory and predictive power, and simplicity to what our astrophysicists are offering us? And the astrophysicists are fairly sure the answer is no. They cannot derive physical principles, they cannot derive science from their from any conception of God, but they can do it with physics. They cannot make the predictions that they've done so ably with from the conception of God, but they can do it with physics. And finally, what about God? Well, if God is as we typically understand God, their worry goes something like this. Well, first thing, we don't know if such a being is even possible. Second thing, it sounds like a fantastically complicated entity. One way of seeing that, and this often surprises people, because usually you think, well, God, what, the three letters is pretty simple, right? I mean, a dog's a lot more complicated than God. But think about it. Back to this mind problem. If God has a mind and knows all things, I think what that comes to is something like, for every proposition, statement, claim, whatever you want to call it, God knows whether it's true or false. That requires, because there's an infinite number of those, an infinite number of representations, you would probably call them thoughts, propositions represented in God's mind, that he can tell you then, whether it's true or false. That's infinite complexity from the get-go. And that is nowhere near the complexity we have postulated in Big Bang cosmology or its variants, many worlds, and so forth. So it looks like you've got an incredibly complicated initial condition in God that doesn't explain anything observable and quantifiable, doesn't predict anything about the structure of the universe, and yet it's madly complex. Not nearly as simple as what the physicists have to offer. So scientists just don't want to play the game. They're like, it's a non-starter, people. God has no explanatory opportunity when you're trying to explain things the way science does, at the level of detail and accuracy that science expects. It's just a non-starter. That's their concern, and I share it with you now. There's a philosophical issue here, too. I don't know what it is that God would create if God was to create. But that is precisely what I need to know. I need to know what his goals are, what kind of world he would make, so that I can then look at this world and I can judge whether this world fits those goals. But we have no idea what those are. If you tell me, well, we know perfectly well, look at the world. Well, that's the issue. Did God create it or not? If we knew from the idea of God and could predict what kind of world he could make, and there are so many different ways to make a world. Read your fantasy books, and it goes far beyond that. Trust me. Then we could actually evaluate the issue. We could answer the question, is this world the sort of world that hypothesis predicts? We can't even approach that question because we have no understanding of what this marvelous being might actually come up with. So again, from a philosophical viewpoint, explanation is what you seek. God's a non-starter. And this is why the intellectual world isn't angry at God. It's not a conspiracy, people. It's not like a war and there are enemies and they are clever. It just doesn't do them any good. They can't get anything out of it unless they go to church. And then what do they get out of it? They get out of what I think you're supposed to get out of it. It's not about knowledge. That is a hollow, false idol. You're not asked to know God. You're asked, as the martyred rabbi asks you, to believe, to have faith. And belief is not knowledge. Faith is not knowledge. These things are a species of hope. And honestly, think about this one. If you want to know what belief is, a lot of you drove today, didn't you? But do you believe in God the way you believe that your car key will start your car? You probably don't. And if you do, you're very unusual. It's not even belief that you have. I think it's hope. And I respect that. How's that?
You have a little more time. About a minute.
So keep hoping. and maybe hope will win in the end. But if we're going to play our games in the bright realm of reason, I think it's extremely important for us to realize that this is not where we're at when we talk about God. If we're just going to do this thing out of reason, I don't think we're going to get God. I think we're going to get a big huh. Because again, we're not even in a position to evaluate whether this entity is even possible. That makes it tough, folks. And that's where hope comes in, because what is hope? You don't hope for what you know. You hope for what you don't know. You don't hope for what you have certainty of. That destroys hope. And it also changes things in such an odd way. Think about the love you have for your husband or your wife or your children. Do they love you back? Do you know with certainty? Or do you have a confidence born out of a luscious sort of hope? A hope that might fail, but that you're willing to take the chance with them. You're willing to, in spite of your inability to read their hearts or minds, you only have their behavior and so much that you don't see, right? Love is about hope. If you want to love God, hope for God. Don't know him. Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Basham. Okay. Please refrain from your applause right now. You will have a chance to do that a little bit later. Now, Pastor Cook, we want to welcome you to Leavenworth as well. You have 15 minutes for your opening statement.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be with you here tonight. And what you are about to hear is a radically different way of looking at the world than you just heard. And that should be expected. I'd like to start by letting you know that tonight I will be defending Christian theism rather than theism in general.
Since Christian theism is the only true form of theism, it is impossible to successfully defend theism in general or some other particular form of theism. The proposition of tonight's debate is, does God exist? And it may appear to shift the burden onto the Christian, but this is not the case at all. The Bible declares that all men know God because God has made himself evident to all men in Romans chapter 1. So it's actually the atheist who is denying the obvious. Thus, the burden of proof lies on his shoulders and not mine. It will not suffice for the atheist to stand back and take pot shots at Christianity or faith or hope without setting forth a positive argument for his own worldview. In order to dismiss the Christian worldview, it will be necessary for the atheist to be standing within his own worldview. You cannot critique a position without having a position of your own from which you offer the critique. In order for a position or a worldview to be true, at least two things must be present. It must be free from a worldview that is inherently contradictory. That is, it must be free from internal contradictions. Secondly, it must also be free from pure subjectivism. In other words, I believe it's true because I just feel that it's true. There are many different angles that I could use tonight to try to prove Christian theism. I could appeal to various aspects of life that we are all familiar with, such as immaterial concepts, human dignity, the laws of logic, uniformity of nature. I could appeal to any one of those aspects of life that, once again, we are all very familiar with. But since my opponent is an atheist, I will demonstrate tonight that he has a sense of morality. I'm going to focus on the narrow application and sense of morality and justice that is internally inconsistent with atheism. Not only is his sense of morality and justice internally inconsistent with atheism, but it can be deduced to a feeling or a subjective preference. He should only make the following types of judgments about the world and about behavior. That behavior or that action is wrong because I feel it's wrong. The type of argument that I'm going to be presenting tonight is known as the impossibility of the contrary. Simply put, there is no contrary position to Christianity that meets the requirements of these three elements. Number one, internal consistency, objectivity, and external consistency with reality. I'm going to attempt to prove that if a person wants to make moral judgments in this life, he cannot justify these moral judgments apart from the existence of the Christian God. The Christian worldview has an explanation as to why men are moral, that they are moral beings that walk around making moral judgments. You see, all men are made in the image of God according to Genesis chapter 1. And being made in the image of God simply means that man has been endowed with certain attributes that God possesses. Some of these attributes include, but are not limited to, the ability to reason, the ability to love, and the ability to make moral judgments concerning human behavior. The Christian God gives us a comprehensive, objective moral standard by way of his commandments. The moral standard is a reflection of his holy moral character. It is the only, and I emphasize, the only objective standard available to man. All other attempts to justify and prescribe human morality can be boiled down to personal preference, one man's preference as opposed to another man's preference. As a Christian, I can say that murder, adultery, homosexuality, theft, and lying are wrong. I can make these statements because God in his word has declared that they are wrong. The atheist, on the other hand, might also agree that these things are wrong. But the problem is, he can't tell us why they're wrong. Therefore, he finds himself at odds with his worldview. It is at this point that he is internally inconsistent and his worldview is in trouble. That is not to say that he won't attempt to offer justification for moral judgments. It is to say that whatever he invents can be easily dismantled and shown to be insufficient by the Christian theist. Whatever justification Dr. Basham wants to offer will be demonstrated to be insufficient and self-contradictory. Now, that's a pretty bold claim for a pastor to make against a university professor. But I'm so confident, and I believe so in my heart, that the Christian message, as revealed to us in God's Word, is true, that I'm willing to put my reputation at stake. I repeat, whatever justification Dr. Basham wants to offer will be demonstrated to be insufficient and self-contradictory. Dr. Basham has authored a paper entitled, Why God Lied to Me. And in the abstract on page 1, he writes, and I quote, "A proper understanding of justice supports the contention that eternal damnation is contrary to justice, and therefore divinely inspired threats of eternal damnation are deceitful," end quote. I want to read this to you again because it's very important that you absorb this paragraph. He says again, quote, "A proper understanding of justice supports the contention that eternal damnation is contrary to justice, and therefore divinely inspired threats of eternal damnation are deceitful." This one sentence will be sufficient to demonstrate that Dr. Basham assumes much more than his atheism can support. Notice that Dr. Basham assumes that there is a, quote, "proper understanding of justice." This assumption requires an objective standard by which justice can be tested. For example, in order to judge that a stick is crooked, you must have the concept of a straight stick. Atheism doesn't provide any type of standard by which judgments concerning justice can be assessed or measured or even condemned. I'm anxious to find out from Dr. Basham where one can appeal to find, as he says, a proper understanding of justice. In the same sentence, Dr. Basham writes, quote, "Divinely inspired threats of eternal damnation are deceitful." Once again, Dr. Basham assumes more than his atheism can prove. In affirming the concept of deceit, you must first presuppose objective truth. Where is the atheist's standard of objective truth? He also assumes that deceit is bad. Well, I believe deceit is bad too, but I can tell you why deceit is bad, because it's inconsistent with God's moral character. I would like to know how Dr. Basham knows that deceit is bad and how he can prove that deceit is bad. Once again, his worldview is deduced to just one man's preference over another. As a Christian, I have an objective standard for justice, truth, and the concepts of good and evil. Dr. Basham does not. Dr. Basham makes these types of claims because he is made in the image of God and has a sense of justice and truth. But because he opposes God and because he suppresses the truth and unrighteousness, his judgments are internally inconsistent and relegate to personal preference. Therefore, I suggest that if Dr. Basham wants to be consistent, he should retitle his paper, "I Don't Like the Concept of Hell." For example, Dr. Basham writes on page 232, and I quote, "I suspect that God, if God exists, is occasionally a liar. This has something to do with the fact that I lie sometimes. And sometimes I even lie for what I sincerely believe to be a morally good reason. Why shouldn't God do the same?" End quote. The problem here is that Dr. Basham wants to create a God who conforms to his image, a God who would do what Dr. Basham would do if he were God. And since the God of Scripture doesn't measure up to the standard that Dr. Basham sets, he must not be real. He wants to set in judgment of the God of Scripture, when in reality, it is the God of Scripture that will set in judgment of him. On page 233, Dr. Basham writes, "I construe justice as either identical with or conceptually inseparable from the notion of giving what is deserved." Here he only offers a definition of the word justice, and I agree with his definition. I'll read it to you again. "I construe justice as either identical with or conceptually inseparable from the notion of giving what is deserved." The problem is that the atheist has no guide for what is deserved. If God is the creator, then let God determine what the punishment is that fits the crime. On page 245 and 246, we continue reading where Dr. Basham states, quote, In order to know what is just, we must also ask, what is the proper aim of the institution that we are dealing with? Does anyone see a problem with this arbitrary guide of justice? Let's take the definition of justice and apply it to the Third Reich. Let's read it again. In order to know what is just, we must always ask, what is the proper aim of the institution that we are dealing with? The institution of the Third Reich, Nazi Germany. The aim? To create a super Aryan race by exterminating Jews. The conclusion, murdering 6 million Jews is just. You see a problem here? Maybe Dr. Basham has realized the problems with these types of statements and is prepared to give us answers that he believes are defensible. We will find out in the cross-examination. In order for Dr. Basham to condemn Hitler and be consistent in doing so, he must become a Christian. At this point, I would like to make a critical distinction. I am not suggesting that atheists are incapable of being moral, but I am suggesting that atheists cannot account for morality or appeal to an objective morality or be justified in making moral judgments. In my experience with atheists, there are only a couple of responses that are offered that try to justify moral judgments. One would be, for example, that which is morally just is that which causes the human race to succeed and survive. And that happens to be Hitler's philosophy also. Another one might be that which is morally just is determined by society. Hitler would give you another amen on that one. Another response is that that which is morally just is determined by the outcome. Now, this shifts the thrust of the question to what is a just outcome. It never answers the question. It only begs the question. And the only way that you could find out what the outcome is if you were omnipotent, and therefore you would have to be God. That which is just is another response that makes you happy. In this scenario, adultery and pedophilia could be considered morally justifiable because it makes people happy for a season. Another response is that which makes you happy without hurting anyone else is what is morally just. Once again, I would have to be omnipotent to know the effects of every moral decision that I make. What about emotional injury? You see, no matter which way you turn, you're going to find yourself in a checkmate when you challenge God in His Word. It is possible that Dr. Basham will offer a different justification for his position. It may also be the case that Dr. Basham will point out that he perceives as other moral injustices in the Bible, or that he will point out other moral injustices in the Bible. But let him be reminded that he must offer a positive standard by which these moral or alleged moral injustices can be scrutinized. He may, for example, appeal to slavery in the Bible, the displacement of pagan nations as Israel took possession of the Promised Land. But all these objections can be answered inside the context of the Christian worldview. If Christianity is true, which I believe it is with all my heart, we need not shy away from the tough questions that are raised by those who oppose the truth. What is at stake here is much more than an intellectual game of chess. What is at stake here are the souls of men for eternity. I don't see this as a game. I see this as a matter of life and death. Thank you.
All right. Thank you very much. At this point, we will now turn to the questioning period of the first half. And to begin that, we will turn to Dr. Basham, who will cross-examine Pastor Cook for 4 minutes. Dr. Basham.
Thank you. We'll get back to my paper later, Gene. I don't think you've understood it, and your excerpts were pleasantly selective. Okay. I wanted to go back, though. Now, Gene, are you a creationist?
I am.
Good. Okay. Now, one of the things that puzzles people who are into biological sciences about creationism is some of the incongruities we find with the notion of God and the evidence we find on the ground. One of the things, there's many, many, you have to understand, there are literally thousands of examples, but I think this one's really clear. Take a look at this and tell me what you make of it. One of the things we've discovered is, as we work our way down through the strata, we find the skulls of dinosaurs. And one of the most interesting things, and consistent across continents, is the lower you go, the lower the strata, the more thick, poorly designed, and kind of sort of bad engineered the skulls are. As you go up, they get much, much better. At the same time, though, these skulls are all made out of physical matter, which quantum mechanics teaches us is exquisitely well-ordered. Now, I assume your view is that the same creature that is having these terrible skulls and then later getting good skulls, dinosaurs, is made by the same creator, that is the creator of the underlying physics these skulls are made out of. But the underlying physics shows great acumen and intelligence, and the skulls are amateurish and fairly poorly worked from an engineering perspective. Well, how could the same God be responsible for both these creations, or must we postulate multiple creators? My question.
Well, the Bible tells us very clearly that God created all life. And so my answer is that God created all life. It's interesting that in your question you presuppose an engineer. You use the word engineered several times. So you have to answer the question, I suppose, who engineered them? I have no problem saying that God engineered all of it.
All right, thank you, Dean.
Yeah.
Fair enough. So you do not address the obvious contradiction and confidence there?
Contradiction such as, non-A cannot be A at the same place at the same time. Maybe you can point out where the contradiction lies.
The contradiction lies in the level of confidence. Quantum mechanics, highly competent. Bad skulls, highly incompetent. Same creator. Contradiction.
If the company, the car manufacturer Honda, makes a Honda Acura and they also make a Honda mini bike, does that imply that the same manufacturer didn't make both?
Are they both equally well made?
Yes.
Well, then you've have no analogy. These are not equally well made.
How would you know?
Because quantum mechanics is exquisite, and as far as we can tell, mathematically perfect. These skulls are a mess. They're
well,
poorly done.
If that's your opinion.
No, it's the opinion of any engineer.
Not a creation scientist. It wouldn't be the opinion of Ken Ham, for example.
Oh, I don't know him.
Well, sure? There you go.
Well, let's ask him.
Do you have another question?
Oh, do I get another one?
Yes, you have 1 minute.
All right. Well, I don't want to talk about creationism and geology anymore because he's going to push the questions off on people who aren't here. So let's do something different. One of the things that occurred to me when I was young was that my relatives may go to hell. And when I got older and I was dealing with students, many times they complained that they were concerned that some of their family members might be in hell while they were in heaven. And they found this to make their happiness in heaven morally and humanly impossible. Is heaven, when your relatives are in hell, happy for only sociopaths?
We only have a few seconds here, but I'd like you to... You answered your question?
No.
All right. That's it. All right. Now we will switch to Pastor Cook. You
really
have 4 minutes to ask questions of Dr. Basham.
Okay, Dr. Basham, do you believe in evolution?
My beliefs are not the issue of this debate.
Oh.
But I would play the game. I really don't know if the theory is true, but it seems to work pretty well. Let's provisionally think I do.
Okay, so you believe in evolution. So you believe that life comes from non-life.
The theory of evolution does not address the origins of life. It addresses changes to established life forms.
Very good. So what is the origin of life?
The origin of life is a problem for molecular biology that they're working on and probably will continue to work on for a long, long time.
So you don't know what the origin of life is?
Well, if we assume that there is no God, and that's not just an assumption, we have huge problems with that proposition, then the origin of life will have to be non-life.
So you
there
believe
are some possibilities people pointed to.
Okay, I just want to reiterate this. You just said that if we take God out of the equation,
yeah,
then the only possible explanation is that life proceeds from non-life.
Oh, no, I don't think that's the only possible explanation, but that's the explanation that the current research program undertook by humankind would be working on first.
Yeah. And how exactly does that happen? Can you explain that to me?
That is a research project for molecular biology that they're still working on.
So are you shifting the burden onto people that aren't here?
No, I'm saying I'm not a molecular biologist.
Please remain quiet,
yeah,
for the questioning period.
Good point.
Okay.
But then if that's what's going on, why ask me these questions? I'm not going to chase you around with science.
Well, anymore. I can answer that question. So if you'd like to answer me, I can explain the origin of life.
Okay. But is that a question?
How do you determine what is just?
How do I determine what is just? I do not have time in this in this moment to tell you, but I will say this. Morality has a function. That seems quite evident. The function of morality appears to be to produce benefit and prevent harm. And this is exactly the function any child would give it. And the function that you understand, all of you, that it has too. Now, harm and benefit are objective features of the world. It is objectively true that if I kill you, I've harmed you. If I torture you, I've harmed you. And it's also objectively true that if I feed you when you're hungry, clothe you when you're naked, I have benefited you. So we have this initial basis. Then the question becomes, what are the full and precise conditions for harm and benefit to beings as advanced and complicated and able as human beings? And there we enter into the great discussions of moral philosophy. My own view of this at this time, and shared by many, many, many people who have reflected carefully upon this issue, is that a critical element of harm to people is preventing them from developing their capacities, should they so choose. A critical element of benefit for people is making clear the way so they can enjoy the capacities that are inherent in them. This is why racism is wrong, and this is why sexism is wrong.
Okay, I think I'm satisfied with your answer. Right. Do you believe that there's a distinction between humans and animals?
I believe there is a distinction between humans and non-human animals, sure. I make it all the time.
Okay, so human animals. So if evolution is true, when did humans cease to be human animals?
I never said they ceased to be human animals. We're obviously animals, Gene.
Okay.
We have skin, we have hair, we have bones, we have blood. If you mean by animal what a biologist means, it is absurd to say humans aren't animals. Your position, as I understand it, is that humans are more than animals. They're animals with a superior supernatural dimension.
Is it okay to kill humans?
Is it okay?
Yeah, is it morally permissible, according to your worldview, to kill humans?
Given the moral theory I've had a moment to enunciate, that would be dependent upon their relationship of their activities to the protection of people's capabilities. So, for instance, self-defense.
We're out of time. Thank you so much, gentlemen. Now we go to the rebuttal portion, and that begins with Dr. Basham. 5 minutes for rebuttal.
Well, the debate began on Gene's side by a discussion of a paper I published back in 2002. It's called, and I've noticed that Gene has never, in the three times he's mentioned the paper, given the full title. That's significant. The full title is Salvationist Justice and Theism, Why God Lied to Me, Salvationist Justice and Theism. Now, here's what the paper offers. The paper offers that not merely, is it a question of an institution's proper function that determines justice, but the kind of institution it is. And the kind of institution I'm addressing in that paper is the institution of the family. Now, what I understand families to be doing is raising people up in a way that can protect them throughout their future lives. And the way I understand Christian theism is that one of the things that a good family can do, especially if it's God's family, is make sure that those children are saved. So then I wonder, now, if you want as many people to be saved as you can, hell's a bad plan. You lose them. And if hell, as conceived by at least traditional orthodoxy, is the kind of hell we're talking about, you lose them for eternity. Is that reasonable for a family to do? Furthermore, I understand that many, many people are bad kids. They are selfish and they are greedy and they are all about me. How could you get them into a situation where they could form a right relationship with the Lord? Here's one possibility. You tell them if they don't, they'll fry. That scares them. Then they start thinking maybe church isn't such a bad idea. Do any of you think maybe I should go to church because I just might fry forever? Well, if you are one of those people, then you kind of started out selfish, didn't you? Now, here's the hypothesis. God knows there's a lot of us out there who are all about me. He knows the only way he can get into right relationship with us is to spook us into a Christian community. And in that community, learn the ways of compassion, the ways of love, the ways of other regard. learn the things that Jesus wants you to know and live. And so God puts forth a proposition. There is a hell, or other people do, and God allows it uncontradicted. He doesn't say, oh, no, 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 those people, they're not telling you the truth. This gets the selfish into the church. This lets the community of a good, loving church, I think a church like the Church of the Open Door, to bring those people to a higher level where they can have relationships with each other that are loving, right relationships with one another, that then evolve into right relationships to God. And the hell deceit is no longer needed. Now, does God deceive? In the Bible, we see he does, and later we'll discuss that. But he does it for the best reasons, just like a little kid sometimes has to be deceived by her parents. Because you can't explain the real deal, and she's not prepared to care. So you set a lie up that later is understood and discarded. That's the thesis of the paper. Thank you.
Right. Pastor Cook, you will now have 5 minutes for your rebuttal.
Thank you. Okay, I want to begin by addressing some of the statements that were made by Dr. Basham in his opening statement. He said that when you're a child, it's easy to accept things like Christianity, but these things become more difficult when you are older. Mr. Basham or Dr. Basham probably doesn't know this, but I didn't become a Christian until I was 26 years old. So I'm not so sure that his theory is correct. He asked, what is God made of? Well, if he was to read John chapter 4, he would find the answer, because God says to the Samaritan woman that God is spirit and he is seeking those who will worship him in spirit and in truth. Dr. Basham says, we know nothing about this material substance that we know is God. Well, I beg to differ. We have 66 books called the Bible that is a collection of God's self-revelation that do primarily that job of revealing to us who this God is. He says that the idea of God is borrowed capital, and we are trying to be better people with more decency. I'm quoting, of course. These are statements that he made in his opening presentation. Well, first of all, in order for him to say that the goal of humanity is to be a better people and that the goal is that we would achieve more decency, he is the one that has to borrow capital. Because once again, in a strictly material universe where everything is just matter and motion, there is no such thing as decency. There is no such thing as a better people. Those are statements and judgments that can only make sense within the context of the Christian worldview. Because it is the Christian worldview that sets forth what is good and what is evil, what is better and what is worse. Holiness is good, sin is bad. And so when he talks about borrowed capital, I think he needs to take a look at his own account. He just got done saying that concerning the question, does God deceive? The Bible tells us that he does. I'm not sure. Are you reading the Satanic Bible? I'm not sure what Bible you're reading. But my Bible says that God cannot lie. And it says it more than once, that God cannot lie. God is truth, and it is completely contrary to his holy nature for him to speak a falsehood. And therefore, like I said, I'm not sure how you deduced that statement or what Bible you're reading, but I'd be more than happy to provide you with one that actually demonstrates that God is not a liar. In fact, that lying is a sin. He mentioned that he kind of takes the National Geographic version, and he mentioned that it is a wholly natural story, that creation, the Big Bang hypothesis, is not only a wholly natural story, but it's a wholly physical story. And you get the impression, without really knowing very much about his understanding of the world, that he's a materialist. And when I asked him if life springs from non-life, he said it would have to, essentially speaking. So he would have you to believe, with all of his education, that life comes from something akin to a rock. Is that what atheism has to offer us? Is that what the scientific community has to reveal to us by way of their intellect and all their studies and all their knowledge? You don't have to be a scientist to know that that is impossible, that that violates even basic cell theory, that that requires something called the uniformity of nature, that life requires the uniformity of nature, that science requires the uniformity of nature, that the scientific method can't even be performed without the uniformity of nature. But yet science can give no explanation for the uniformity of nature based on their inductive reasoning. It's quite the fairy tale that there's an explosion that takes place millions of years ago, and out of that, out of the goo, comes me and you. That's really silly. And I don't mean to impugn my opponent's intelligence, but I'm just calling it as I see it. It's much more sensible and much more logical and much more practical and much more consistent with a worldview that makes judgments about morality and justice to believe in the Christian God. I have much more to say, but I believe I'm out of time. Thank you.
Thank you, both of you gentlemen. This brings us to the close of our first half of our debate. I believe we have a few announcements before we go to our break.
All right, very good. We're going to take a short intermission, just maybe about 5 minutes. We've got some coffee, donuts in the back. Bathroom, again, is back here down to the stairs. Now, this will be the time on your sheet. You see a little portion there to write questions. This will be the time to write those down. When we all get seated, we'll then collect those questions. We've got some pens in the back and some materials that you can start to look at. They'll be there at the end. But we'll, again, take a short intermission right now, and I'll give you like a 1-minute warning to sit down. Thank you.